you've got this blank canvas and maybe you're looking at how early product pods should look and like components that should go into, you know, maybe you've got this amount of engineers, you've got this amount of designers, you've got, but I actually think the thing which is on my mind here is that every organization is going to be different, right?
Of course.
Everyone is trying to have, you know, six different answers to those six different questions. And so while there might be some directional truths, I mean, you might need some folks to build, you might need some folks to sell. I think if you actually, you're spending the time on what is it that our factory is shaping up to do, what is it that we cannot do at the moment or that we're really sort of struggling to do and that matters. If you can think about all that, then it really makes sense to me here that you want someone who is going to be flexible with all that evolving. And so you really need specialists.
Welcome to Startup Jobs, a podcast where we explore all the different jobs inside a tech startup. What exactly are they and what have we learned from scaling jobs from the inside?
While a lot of other startup content focuses on the founder, the investor, or specific area like marketing, this show is about your personal and career growth journey in whatever startup job is best for you.
Yeah, exactly, Maddie. This show is about you. We want you to be the very best that you can be.
Hey, hey, we can't shake you, Kai. We've got another episode with our special guest.
I haven't been kicked out just yet. It's good to be back.
What's on the docket?
Kai, you sort of came, you came with this topic today, which I think we both kind of got different things we want to quiz Mike about. So do you want to share your sort of, what kind of led you to this topic today?
Yeah, so, working on a new startup, new company, we're starting to think about, if we were to raise some cash, like how do we really map out who the first hire should be?
Mm.
We obviously have a heap of sort of capability between, myself and my co-founder. You can kind of map that out. You can go, look, this is the stuff that we're comfortable doing. But then there's this whole massive, amount of stuff that we've got no idea how to do that we haven't done before and that you probably will need for that company to succeed. And then I'm just sort of sitting here going, like, I actually be interested to hear your thoughts, Mike, and yours as well, Maddie, on sort of how that decision can be made, sort of relative to what you want to get done as a company. So perhaps it's less so about kind of, well, maybe it is. It's about the type of person, but it's also the kind of role. I think the role itself and the sort of the role that person plays, perhaps even just the things that they have to get done for you, that's probably the biggest question in my mind. Maybe secondary to that is sort of attitude and values and sort of culture piece as well. That's what I'm here to chat about, and I'm keen to your thoughts.
Yeah, awesome. I love it. And then I might add my sort of side to this as well, Mike, while your mind is racing with ideas. Yeah, I guess I joined the hiring side of Zipline when, we'd probably had 100 staff through the company already by the time I joined. And so I guess I took on the principles you'd sort of like learnt from different successful and failed hires. And so, yeah, I guess keen to get a bit of insight into sort of the position you were in back where Kai is now, all the way back in the Rate It days. And how you thought about that, because I think I've probably, in the head of people and culture role, adopted and taken on some pretty great hiring principles, but I don't really I've come to understand sort of the learnings behind them, but didn't live the pain that sort of created those principles. So, yeah, I guess just from the raw emotions and learnings that you had back then, how that has now shaped our hiring approach, which, has become, it's a pretty good approach, I reckon, tried and tested, and still plenty to improve as we get back into hiring as well. So yeah.
So much here. We're live in a Google Doc and I'm like assembling my thoughts, and Maddie Kai can see my five bullet points that I jotted down.
This is actually how Talkback Radio works. Like,
does it?
When I used to do like Sunday.
Sorry, you
interning.
Used to do Talkback Radio?
Well, I used to go in and
say much at the wee old age of 18.
I've seen
19,
the photos of you.
Yeah. Okay. But when I was, I did
like
going to
forever say Kai's 18.
When I was I just did like a couple of Sundays at the ABC, just like basically taking calls for their talk back.
Oh, right.
And the presenter would have a Google Doc, and we'd have a Google Doc sort of in the call center area.
Oh,
and you just basically just like, here's the person, here's the topic, like and they just move it around. So literal Google Doc to do that job.
So what we're actually doing here.
It's very mature.
World class. Best man. Best practice.
Maddie, can we take in we should do that. Can we
That's rabbit hole.
Take in
live callers.
We'll keep leveling up.
In the future. all right. Okay. So many battle scars. So much to say. You know, the good news is I don't have anything unique to say on the topic. You know, I think if you consumed, you know, all of the web and everyone that's smart that has succeeded in whatever form in business and they talk about like first hires, it will all triangulate on some of these, you know, broad points that, you know, I'm sharing here. So, yeah, I mean, and you know, I would start by inserting all the quotes that Steve Jobs has got, some really, really great quotes around like your first hires, you know, just shape, like that just totally shape the company and totally shape the, you know, the culture and just how critical it is getting those first 1, 2, 3, 4 hires. And Brian Chesky, founder at Airbnb, has got a great talk on, it's on the Stanford How to Start a Startup. I'd have a look at that where he talks about this as well. So yeah, I think that's all like super good reminders just as to how important it is, the fact that you're asking the question or we're thinking about it. You know, if you've joined a startup and certainly if they're sub 5-10 people, even if you're not the founder, like you should be thinking about this stuff as well and obsessing. Yeah, or if you dream one day of going and doing your own thing and, you know, if you're fortunate enough to get legs where you would need to hire someone or think about this topic, then, you know, this is all like super relevant. So I would start by thinking from the perspective of how did General Electric, when, you know, Jack Welch was, you know, arguably one of the best CEOs of his time when he came into General Electric and really, you know, did some amazing stuff. How is it that they went from a ballpark, I haven't memorized the exact numbers, but how is it that they went from a 20% success rate of hiring? So they would hire someone and then a year later,
4 and 5
they would say 20% of the time they got it right. Like they absolutely nailed it, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that they fired others 80% of the time, but that they got a top talent. They got a great A player hire for that role. How do they go from 20% to 90%, right? so like I would say there are systems to this and we shouldn't fall for it's some sort of like black box voodoo magic of like interviewing and you either connect with the person and they seem like a culture fit and you have a intuition or a feeling, you know, or you don't. Like there's actually close to no black box to hiring well. Like they're like if you follow the principles and the algorithms, you can get to 90%. And you know, as someone who like my personality type is more natural on the kind of feeling and intuition side, you know, as opposed to like hyperlogical engineering brained, right? Like just different people have different personality types. It's taken me a while to like I thought my intuition would be able to get it right. And so actually just seeing my intuition get it wrong a lot has helped. I would pair that with so you can get to 90%, like you can never get to 100% because, you know, humans are weird. Just, you know, outlier things do happen. But if it goes well or it doesn't go well, it's always your fault because you're the one that, so at no point, anyone that I've ever hired or anyone that's joined and they didn't work out, that was always my fault because we didn't hire right. So again, it kind of basically all the burden of responsibility is on you and there's a process for it.
Great.
Okay, so what's the process? There's really like two parts to the process actually. One part is like the who, which is like back to the 6 questions, which is how do we behave? So this is the values bit. So you cannot, that is a non-negotiable, right? So the who must pass the core values pass, right? Test. And so we can talk about how to test for that because there's ways to test for it. And we can talk about how do you spend time getting a minimal viable level of core values, you know, when you don't have a perfect six bullet points, right? Actually, one of my brothers started a building company a handful of years ago. And when he had to make his first hire, like he came to me and he was chatting about this, and he knew the job description, he knew the type of person, like, you know, the actual role, but he didn't have any core values. And then he sort of felt like, oh, like it's going to take so long to come up with company core values, but you can actually come up with a lean version of core values, which we'll talk about. So that's one part. And then the second part is what is the role, but taking a factory line perspective to it. So a lot of people go, oh, I need a salesperson, or I need a project manager, or I need a, like, whatever the job title is. And then there's like some generic responsibilities, and that's what I go out and hire for. What people don't do, and what we've only like recently been good at, is thinking about it like a factory line. So what do I mean? So think of it as like, if you had a factory that you got some raw ingredients, I don't know, let's make it a vegan sausage factory, right? So you had carrots, carrots from the farmer come into the factory.
Yep.
Okay. You're like, cool, no worries. I can do that, right? Like I can work with the farmers and I can get the delivery to our warehouse. Okay, cool. And then after all the carrots come in, the next stage is they've got to be like mashed up, right? So then there's a machine.
The masher upper.
Needs to mash them all up, right? Yeah, okay, cool. That's step two. And then step three is I've got to mix it with some other things and put some ingredients in. You know, step four is it gets, you know, baked. And, you know, step five is, you know, it gets shrink wrapped, et cetera, right? So then you kind of go, okay, what's actually happening in my company right now? And where is the pain that I don't have this machine right now? So an example would be we've got so many packets going through the machine, we're manually wrapping so much, or the guy who's like bringing trucks in has to keep going from there and going over to manually wrapping. So therefore we need a wrapping machine, right? So to bring that back to the job that you're hiring for, like what is it that the human is doing in that overall machine? And do you have the projected pain now? Like, e.g., you're not sending enough packets out the door because you're not wrapping enough, or, you know, they keep falling on the floor because you're not wrapping fast enough. Which then gets to defining that role. And so what we then need is we need a wrapping machine, and the wrapping machine is successful if it can wrap, you know, 10 packets of vegan sausages per minute, as an example, right? Then you can then go out to the market and look for machines that can wrap, you know, at 10 packets per minute, and you would judge that machine being successful if they packed. Okay, so how does this, and then you just translate all of this to humans, right? So you kind of go, okay, I need a salesperson, you know, whatever it may be, that can take, you know, 10 leads and turn them into two deals. Or I need, you know, an engineer that can do like this, and like develop like this amount or whatever it may be. And then defining not what the role is in generic terms, but defining how will you see whether this factory machine, if you will, is successful or not.
Yeah.
The shout out that I would give is like our business coach Brad has got a book called Onboarded, and it defines this perfectly, right? It's like you basically start with the end in mind, which is you define the role and how they will be successful. And then that's how you then interview to that. And the method of top grading is sort of like how to go through the interview process to assess both the core values, so the who, you know, together with the what, which is the defining, you know, this machine or this human is successful, you know, at this thing, if it's producing these outputs. We can touch on how it's messier in the early stages, but I'd be keen, Maddie, because you've been on the ride with us doing recruitment where we were pretty clear on our core values and like how to like interview for that. And then we got clearer, you know, on the second point. Yeah, so any commentary in seeing some of this?
Yeah, I guess breaking it into the two of like core values first, and then secondly, like being successful in the specific role. A lot of I guess what we probably have learned and refined is being ultra clear on this as well, like ridiculously clear, that makes it actually okay if you scare some people off. I think we might have like adapted our
approach. So good.
At some time where we potentially weren't as honest as we could be of just like, I think we used the analogy of like a conveyor belt for a while, that, you know, working here is like a conveyor belt, like the work will keep coming and it is intense and like you can work incredibly hard, but we also want you to balance that with your own like work-life balance and mental toughness, etc. But we were pretty, I remember getting really honest in a bunch of those interviews after we had a few hires that didn't quite work out, to just make it really known what you're signing up for. And I remember having a conversation with yourself, Mike, around when you say that, it will excite the right person and it will scare off the wrong person. And watching that play out, like that is very true. And I think, yeah, the more you can just be clear and honest with how you operate and what your people are like, the better. And I think that's point one, just being like really honest about the work environment and being comfortable scaring off the wrong person. And yeah, secondly, the lived values. I think when we got really clear on defining our values and the behaviors that you would then exhibit, sharing those values with the candidate and being like really candid and honest about what we're assessing for, and then giving them a really good opportunity to display that. I think sometimes values interviews, you know, values can be vague and hard to, you know, the questions that you might be asking aren't even really that well linked to a value, whereas ours are really clear and we make it really well known. Yeah, that's also been really valuable. Yeah, they'd be my takeaways.
Yeah, I think I remember back in the day you talking about widgets, right? And this is really how it slots into the factory machine piece, yeah. Right? Where you've got folks that, you know, I need you to be spending 7 widgets a week and, you know, at the moment, and we need those 7 widgets now to be able to hit this and that. And
yes,
this is what we're doing as a company, right? Back to those six questions. And it's like, you're doing 3 at the moment. Like,
yeah.
Obviously you can get onto sort of managing people down the track, but like, I think actually setting that makes sense. And the widgets kind of framing was always what stuck with me on this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think when you're early on, it's easy. Yeah. So like the biggest 2 mistakes would be not being clear on our core values and just hiring if they feel great, or, you know, like there was some sort of connection and it's like, oh, I'm going to like enjoy being around this person, or they seem to be a good fit. But we didn't really battle test it against our core values. And we can see everyone that hasn't been a good fit, again, which is my fault, it was because we didn't clearly stress test them in the interview process, you know, to the core values. And I can actually point to how they would have failed our new interviewing process around our core values, right? And again, just because they fail with us doesn't mean that they're a failure as a human. They're just not a right fit for us, right? And we've been clear about that. We're not an everyone company. Like our goal is not to be a great fit for everyone. Like our goal is to be clear on who we are and what we're trying to get done. So we've either failed that, or we've rushed the second one and it's just like we're busy, you know, or we've taken some money and we need to like do some extra stuff. And we haven't actually taken the time to really unpack like, where are you putting this machine in the factory? And it's not fair for them. Like, how do they be successful, right? Like, and if we haven't spent the time thinking about that, and what are we willing to tell them in 3 months' time? Hey, you actually haven't been successful in this role because you didn't, you know, pack, you know, you didn't pack 7 packets, you know, per minute or whatever it may be. Like, it's unfair to judge them on that after they've taken the job. It's unfair to judge them against that and you don't even know what that is. And then it's unfair for them to accept a job and they don't know what they're going to be measured against as successful. And that is always really, 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 really hard. Like that is really, really hard because you're not even too sure, okay, why is it that we're hiring, right? Like, oh, because sometimes you know the bigger picture, which is like, oh, we need to sign up another bunch of customers or we need to do that. But you haven't done the work of breaking it down into what exactly is the machine that you need to put into this factory line? And then how, like I almost view it as you're renting that machine, right? Which is paying a human their wage. When would you know whether you'd hand the machine back to the supplier that you're leasing it from to go, actually, you know, it's not performing. you've got to do the hard work at the start to be able to define that. And I would say that it's never, ever, ever been worth rushing it. Like it's never, ever worth not being clear about that. So yeah, if you get those two things in a good spot, then you're already like way ahead. And then I think on the core values, like when you're early on, you know, if you're not clear on them, then, you know, the hack is to just be anti-values. So I remember asking my brother going, all right, like let's list all the people that you haven't enjoyed working with. And that's pretty easy. Like people have a list of, and I'm like, okay, cool. Like you didn't enjoy working with Betty. Why is that? Okay, because she was always this. Okay, so it sounds like that person, you know, was stuck in a victim mindset and they couldn't get out of, you know, that victim mindset. So, okay, the ante to that is a growth mindset. Like, is that a deal breaker for you? Like, would you have someone in the company that was 80% victim mindset? And he's like, oh, no. Okay, well then some version of growth mindset, you know, is one of them. Okay, like what's the next? And you can just go through a list of all the people that you haven't enjoyed working with and the reasons why. And then also the opposite, what are all the people that you've really loved working with and what's the behaviors that they've displayed? And then you can kind of whittle, like before you know it, you'll have a list of 5 or 6 bullet points. And even if they're not the perfectly defined values, and then you can work backwards to, okay, how would we test for that? And then you ask a bunch of questions that are behavioral based, you know, tell me a story of, you know, where you had a bunch of setbacks and you didn't think you could do the hard, challenging thing. But you know, and so that's kind of like the hack to get past, you know, the values one, you know, through a hiring process, you know, if you had it all figured out.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've kind of got a question that's come from this that I'm just thinking about is that I almost want to throw in, I don't know, a third bucket. So if we've got the core values bucket, the role bucket.
Yeah.
I guess what I was sort of getting at with my point as well is almost like an environment bucket and how they're going to survive in your specific culture, which does link to the core values. But I've just got, just when you were sort of explaining, like the factory line analogy is great and I totally understand that from the role perspective. Mm. But in the zip line right now, I feel like potentially maybe that's a little bit too simplistic in that a lot of the times, not always does someone just operate within their job scorecard or like they're hired for role. And so, you know, we've seen multiple people in the company, I guess both Kai and I included, like everyone included almost, where you've started in a certain role, you've taken on a bit more responsibility. Essentially, you're doing two roles at once. You're wearing a new hat every hour, every day, like whatever it might be. And that's something that is very clear in a lot of successful fits at Zipline is it's someone who's able to sort of jump in and pick up something quickly and execute and is like willing to wear multiple hats. And I would say in Kai's instance right now, hiring like the third person in a company, absolutely that's like a superpower that he'll be looking for. So is there, and I guess that's, you know, like indicative of the environment and the amount of people who are working there and sort of the stage that you're at. So is there almost like a spark that you've seen, Mike, in these people who can do that well? Like I'm thinking of M as like the perfect archetype of this. Like is there a spark you spot in these people who you know are going to succeed in this chaotic environment? Because I think for Kai, hiring a third person in a company, this person's going to need to have it.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, so I mean, what you're talking about is like the T-shape individual. And when you're early, you need to be more T-shaped, which is you may have deep expertise in one area with the vertical axis, but you're very broad and can go very broad on the horizontal axis, as opposed to you're hiring an eye. You know, like the bigger you're in an organization, the more you can hire eyes as opposed to T's. I would like to think that you can define that T shape like in that factory. So the factory may only be like three things then, right? It's like we've got to like somehow figure out how to get a lot of carrots into this address. Okay. That's like really messy. That sits with, you know, Dylan. Okay. And then the second, after we have all these like carrots and, you know, raw like veggies that come in, then we've got to somehow figure out like how to smash it all up and turn it into a thing. Okay. That's, you know, that's Julie. And then we then got to like package it and make sure we sell, you know, at least blah. Okay. And then that's, you know, that's Jimmy. And so it could be as simple as that. And then how to then be successful in that big broad bucket, you're going to have to be super T-shaped, right? Like you can't just, like if you own third one, you can't just be great at sales because you've somehow got to figure out how to like package this stuff up and like send it out and then And so I would like to think that some of that T-shaped stuff, which is so true early on, hopefully shows up in the like kind of what's required in the role. But I really like what you said around like what it's like here now. And, you know, something that I've done probably in the last year and a half, which has been maybe a bit longer actually, the last handful of years, is, you know, if they pass the acid test, you know, values, if they've a good fit for the role and you're kind of clear about it, then as you get to the final stages, you know, kind of like try to scare them off a little bit. Like here is the, like, here is the raw reality of what it looks like. Okay. Like this is going to be a typical day in the life of, this stuff's a bit messy. We haven't figured this out. You know, it looks like this, you know, quite often we do, you know, this thing, whatever it may be. And so I think it can be easy to just focus on the polish on both sides of the of the table, right? You're trying to present the best image of the opportunity and they are looking through the eyes. It's like a first date, right? Like they're also looking. And so I think you want to be really explicit about all the, you know, all the bumpy bits and what it looks like. And that will either attract them more or that will make them clearer about what it is that they're signing up for. And so that way you minimize the chances of, 2 months in, they're like, oh, fuck, this is actually a lot harder than what I thought. Like, I didn't realize that actually every supermarket I engage with have tried veggie sausages before and they never sold. And actually half my job is trying to figure that out, right? It's like, oh, you could have told them that at the interview stage to say, hey, like the reality is like we got a great product and we got a small amount of people who absolutely love it, but like you're going to spend a lot of time like, and we haven't figured that out yet. And that's, and just sort of being pretty transparent about that, that will either make them really excited about helping slay that challenge for you. It will scare them off, or at the very minimum, they're very clear when they get into the seat. You should almost think of it as like, there should be very little surprises and expectations when they actually sit their bum in the role in the first week or two. It should be like, oh, this is broadly like how it was described, as opposed to, I saw a, I saw a Tinder profile and I couldn't find that person in the cafe because they didn't, look or act anything like, their profile. Like that's what you don't want.
Yeah. And I feel like that's not the norm. The amount of times you're chatting to a friend who's going into a new role or something and you're like, so what are you doing? They're like, actually, I have no idea. I have no idea what my job is. Don't know. Like I got a couple of friends starting new jobs and it's like, actually crazy to realize how common it is to go into a role that you don't really know a heap about. And I've seen us level that up as well and make it more and more clear to new hires what they're getting into. Has hence made hiring a lot more successful.
Yeah. I think, for my side, you've got this blank canvas and maybe you're looking at how early product pods should look and like components that should go into, maybe you've got this amount of engineers, you've got this amount of designers, but I actually think the thing which is on my mind here is that every organization is going to be different, right?
Of course.
Everyone is trying to have, six different answers to those six different questions. And so while there might be some directional truths, I mean, you might need some folks to build, you might need some folks to sell. I think if you actually, you're spending the time on what is it that our factory is shaping up to do? What is it that we cannot do at the moment or that we're really sort of struggling to do and that matters? If you can think about all that, then it really makes sense to me here that you want someone who is going to be flexible with all that evolving. And so you really need specialists. Like, that's the sense that I've got, that the specialists will often sort of scale companies, putting aside sort of senior positions. But
yes.
I don't know if generalist is the right word here. I think T-shaped is kind of, it makes sense because there'll be a specific thing they're probably still solving. But that was what came to mind. Yeah, that kind of generalist versus specialist
and
magic.
And it's, and look, we can, like what I love what our coach does, he's got this concept, which it comes from, I think her name's Sharon Suzuki. There's a book called Metronome. It's called like a key process flow map. And, this, I can share an edited version of this publicly. And this is kind of like what the factory, looks like. And I think every business, even an early startup, is going to have a version like of this as well. So like, let me kind of just quickly describe, visually what I'm displaying here, because sort of, there is no, there is kind of like every business needs to do this. So like the sort of step one is you need to have some sort of value proposition, which is what you're going to market to say, hey, I've got this widget. Like, do you want this widget? Right. That could be selling, sausages. It could be selling, like downloading an app. It could be, you know, selling like software to a business. So sort of step one is some sort of value prop generation. And then after you've got a value prop, and that's an iterative process that's never done, right? That's right. Like a messy thing, but that's either red, amber, or green, right? And we can define how does the value prop go green. You know, that's some form of like early product market fit, you know, effectively, right? So like the market wants the solution that you're providing, right? And so then after you've got a pretty good value prop, then you need to be able to find customers. Like there is no business in the world that can exist without finding customers, you know, or users, like whether it's B2B or B2C. Okay, so you got to find a way to find, to get customers, right? And so that's, you're either going to like run Facebook ads or Google ads, or you're going to run like sales motions, or if you're a retail shop, you got to figure out like how to get people into your shop. Like there is no escaping demand generation. Okay, so how are we going to do demand gen? Okay, so then, all right, now we've got some demand. Now we've got some interest. We've got people signing up. We've got people walking into my shop, whatever it may. Well, then we now need to get a commitment. We now need to get a transaction, right? So step three is like, there's got to be a sale. And then that sale then flows into either money straight away. You know, they buy FPOS or, you know, they sign a contract. And then at the same time, we now need to deliver the service that they've signed up for. Like we either give them the product, or, you know, they onboard and we implement it and they use the product, or, you know, they have some experience. And if we're in a recurring business, they're going to make their mind up again in a month's time or in a year's time or in 3 years' time. Do they want to keep going with this? Right. So then they're going to go through a renewal process. And each step in the process, like if the previous one is red, then it's very, very hard for the next step in the factory line to go green. Right. Yeah, so hypothetically, if demand gen was red, you know, there's not enough, then it's very, very hard for sales to go green, and it's very hard for product to go green and for renewals to go green, right? Where if demand gen is green, but you're not going green in sales, well, then you've got a problem there in the factory line. And so I just think like breaking this down like this makes it very easy, even if you're two people or three people. And when you're then hiring, like you may just put a broad bucket saying, yeah, again, Julie is responsible for value prop, you know, and demand gen. And now obviously value prop is together with like the product and the service. So, you know, these things, you know, mixed together. But yeah, I think viewing it as like as a factory is like a really, really helpful way of thinking, even in a T-shaped individual, because there's lots of messy stuff that's got to happen underneath and it's iterative or what have you. But when you're looking to add more people into this thing that we're calling a factory, this thing called a business, this thing called a new company, what you want to be is really clear about, yeah, who owns what in that factory line and how do we define whether something goes green or red? Like just even that at the highest level,
yeah,
you know, puts you, you know, light years ahead of any other early stage startup that's trying to figure out hiring, et cetera.
One last thought from me. What comes to mind is the founder movie. Of the Macca's creator.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a great scene in that movie for those that have seen it, which is him basically, I forget his name. He's got the sort of local basketball court.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
And he's got masking tape, and he's mapping out how he'll have his different pieces of equipment in the back of that McDonald's.
Yes.
And he's, you know, he spends the whole night kind of going through all these different iterations, pretending to be making the milkshakes, pretending to be flipping the burgers,
right,
the patties. And I think it's interesting you take that versus like a food truck, right? Where maybe you got two people, call it two co-founders,
right,
who are kind of, they've got a simplified setup, they're going between all of them, they've got a couple of different hands going. It's like, it's almost taking that next step and going like, well, what do we want this kind of kitchen to look like?
Yes.
If we did have some specialist pieces of equipment,
yes,
and some folks sort of running each station, and then, you know, maybe that's the org chart mapping or the sort of, you know, I don't know, there's all the specifics of the metaphor, but very similar to a factory, I guess, but even just in the kitchen, that's what came to mind.
But yeah, you can imagine like if you're a new startup and it's not clear between two early founders, it's like, well, who's responsible for getting demand gen, getting,
yeah,
people to the food truck? And if they're tripping over each other, sometimes one person's optimizing something in the kitchen, another person, like someone's in Canva building a flyer, and then someone, yeah, else is like doing something. Like, A, that's a problem. But then B, imagine you hire someone and you're not clear on,
yeah,
that. And then they then come in the mix. Like there's just so much waste, not only in cost, but there's all, like, it's just so hard for that person like to be successful if they're not clear on,
totally,
broadly where is my area. And even if it even if you haven't figured out how to do it, you can still figure out what the outcome is that you're after, right? Like, we are successful if people who start using the product renew after, you know, 30 days, like as an example, like even at the highest level. And that's what we're bringing you in for. And there could be a whole bunch of T-shaped things that they need to do.
Get creative.
But yeah, like at least sort of defining, you know, that area. So I think even in the very, very earliest of messiest stages, you can break these things up like a factory line and you can be clear about it. And then you can work backwards to then, you know, hiring for that. And then you'll quickly figure out, you know, who's going to be who has the best shot at being successful, you know, in that mix. Maddie, I know you've got to roll off, but we wanted to get a bit of the three-way magic, chatting about whatever was on Kai's mind, of which early stage hiring is one.
Yes.
I would just say, yeah, it's sort of less messy and black boxy as what you think and then what one might think. Any sort of takeaways or areas worth fleshing out as we bring this one to a close?
I think my key takeaway and the key point, I think like there's so many gems in that. I honestly think it's scary to scare off candidates, but that has been so beneficial for us because it's a little bit of like you're trying to sell them the dream because you want them, they want you, like, you know, you're trying to balance that. And as a recruiter on my side, feels really weird to try and scare someone off. Like you're always trying to tell them how great it is, how much you love it and stuff, but it's almost the acknowledgement that this place doesn't suit everyone. And it would be a disservice to both of us if I don't tell you the truth and make it really clear. So actually feel comfortable scaring them off by being really honest. And yeah, it's going to excite the right person. So I think that's been the biggest gem that I've learned like through the practice of hiring and that we covered in this podcast today.
Nice.
Wicked. Briefly from me, I think the factory and sort of slash Macca's sort of back area diagram in my head makes a lot of sense. I was probably saying I'll take away from this, but the specific one is actually anti-values and that activity of sort of who have I worked with before that I really didn't like spending time with at work, and maybe the flip side.
Yes.
It feels very approachable as an activity for most people, even your brother starting a building sort of company to sit down and do.
Yes.
And so, and probably just the emphasis that you made there around actually this really does matter. Like this first sort of handful of people are really sort of trajectory setting people in your business. So yeah, that was a big one for me.
And getting it wrong, like, you know, sets you back
right
6 months and a lot of money and a lot of heartache. And so sometimes we can feel in this rush to get a bum on the seat. You know, particularly when you experience, you know, good growth problems, then you're kind of like, man, like we've got so many packets of sausages falling on the floor that aren't being wrapped because I don't have that machine in there. And so you can just the first or the second interview, oh, you've like wrapped sausages before, like, all right, fine, you got the job.
Yeah.
But it's never worth rushing it. Like that month that you may have saved by like quickly making a call there, it it's never worth it for the 6 months of pain for not being right.
Yeah.
And then spending the extra time to either scare them off, clearer about it, you know, stress test the values a bit more. It's never been worth it. And then yeah, the last thing I'd finish on is like running a really good onboarding process, so where both sides can make a very, you know, quick decision, right? Like I really love the, you know, Zappos had this thing of like, I think it was like when they finished their first week of onboarding or induction, do you know the number? It was like a really big number for like an entry level role. Like it was someone joining their call center, you know, so maybe they're getting a little bit above minimum wage. It was something like, we will now pay you 3 months of your salary if like you quit right now. It was like something really crazy where basically if someone has been there for the first week or two and they've got like some niggling concerns that they're not gonna like be great or successful,
hey, jump
made
out.
It very easy for them to like exit now. And you may not necessarily implement that exact thing, but I think you want something in the first, you know, 1 to 2 months that if there's any niggling sense on either side that this is unlikely like to be a smash it out of the park success, then you want to make that call early. Like I've never seen like fairly strong niggling feelings in the first month or two. All of a sudden a year later, turn around and go, oh, we got that completely wrong, right? Now, ideally, it's mapped to values or it's mapped to the jobs, but you're far better. It's a lot easier in the first 4 weeks to go, actually, do you know what? Like, James didn't work out, you know, for these reasons. Either he made the call or we made the call. It's so much harder when you're like 6 months in, 9 months in, you know, 12 months in, and you're sort of just like hoping, oh, maybe they'll get, you know, maybe that attitude thing will improve. Like, oh, maybe I can just, and look, some things can be skills that can be taught for sure. But there are some core pieces. They're going to take a very, very long time for someone to make material changes on, like values is one of them. And so I think you want to be able to be in a position where you make that call like pretty quickly. It's the classic, like, you know, hire slowly, offboard quickly, you know, if it's not working. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the other thing that sort of just goes hand in hand with this this process of early hires and getting it right.
Notes have been taken. Thank you, Mark.
Maddie, thanks for hanging late with us. Kai, great to be with you. We'll call that a wrap for how to not fuck up your early hires.
Excellent. Great resource.
Amazing. Thanks for joining us, Kai.
Thanks, Mads. Thanks, Mark.
Hey there. Thanks for listening to today's episode of Startup Jobs. This episode was made in collaboration with our friends at Early Work Academy, Australia's only tech sales bootcamp with a job guarantee. Applications are currently open for the next cohort, and all of the details are in the show notes. And finally, if something resonated with you in today's episode, we're posting episodes like this every week, including CEO memos straight from Michael. The best way to get these episodes on the day is by hitting the follow button on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We'll see you next time.